cases, case number 78401, City of Nevada versus Gallegos. We have Mr. Roach representing the City of Nevada's appellant, Mr. Gamond representing the respondent, Ms. Gallegos. Okay, Mr. Roach, would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
You may do so. Okay.
Justices, may it please the court. Everything I just said is mostly applicable to this case as well. We're once again asking this court to do what it did in Lloyd and take note of whether or not the exigency requirements imposed in Rice are well thought out and well reasoned and whether they should exist. In this case, Ms. Gallegos, I think is perfectly illustrative of why that Rice case was confusing. And an officer ran a person, Ms. Gallegos, for warrants, found out she had a warrant, and at the same time another officer was placing her in handcuffs, he went through her purse right in front of her at the same time she was being arrested. And Judge Porter suppressed that evidence that was located in that purse because once that purse was in the custody and control of the officer and another officer had control of the arrestee, there were no longer exigent circumstances to search that purse, and she held that the officer should have.
Under Rice, though, do you feel that the district court judge erred if we were to not change the standard under Rice? Wouldn't it be fair to say that the district court was correct in its assessment?
I do believe that the district court reasonably applied Rice.
And if we
don't. That's established Supreme Court precedent. The district court judge is not always going to be courageous enough to disregard that and say, this is what the Fourth Amendment really requires. And that's why you can see in her order that she acknowledged that this court has the authority to go beyond the contours of the Fourth Amendment. She recognized that Rice afforded more limitations on a search incident to arrest than Supreme Court Fourth Amendment jurisprudence.
Did they properly inventory her purse as opposed to the last case? Is that why that wasn't argued in this particular case?
No, there are some factual differences. Like we talked about with the last case, Ms. Nye was arrested 2 minutes from the police station in Elko. Ms. Gallegos was in a casino in West Wendover, which is over 100 miles from the Elko County Jail, more than an hour and a half drive. Theoretically, they could have inventoried it, but that was not argued in the court below. The parties didn't argue that it would have been discovered pursuant to an inventory search. It was much more on point of whether or not Rice should be overturned or not, and I think the parties in briefing Ms. Gallegos' case had a straightforward argument. Can you search a purse that someone had when they came into, when they met with the officers, you find that they have an arrest warrant, can you search their purse at the time you arrest them? That's a pretty straightforward question, and that's why I think that the briefs Gallegos are limited to that.
Well, why should they be allowed to search the purse when they arrest them?
For the reasons that I previously stated, that a purse is associated with your purse. It's immediately associated with your person. And based on that, there should be a categorical rule that anything that's immediately associated with a person at the time they're being arrested should be subject to a search.
And the reason for the categorical rule is that there's kind of this legal presumption put in place that if it's on your person, it could present a danger or might be destroyed if you don't find it now.
Those are the chimal factors that undergird the reason for a search incident to arrest.
And those wouldn't be concerns if the purse is now a few feet away on a table over there with two police officers in between us.
There were no in this. That's not the factual scenario we have in this case.
Please.
In this case, the purse was an arm's length from her. She was seated in a chair next to a table. The video was provided to the court. The purse was right here next to her. He took it off of her shoulder. He asked her to take it off her shoulder and set it down on the table next to her. There were no officers between her. Sergeant Abrams was across the room from her. The other officer was in and out through the door. She was, at all times, the closest person to the purse. It was within her custody and control, even though it was no longer.
Wasn't she handcuffed?
No.
She wasn't.
At the time of the search?
At the time of the search, she was handcuffed. But at the time it was on the table, which is what the question was, she was not handcuffed.
Okay, but before someone went into her purse to look through it, she was handcuffed.
She was in the process of being handcuffed. There was an officer standing with her who had her arms. I don't know that it's clear from the video when exactly the handcuffs were clipped, but he was searching the purse at the exact same time the other officer was placing her in handcuffs. That's the kind of ad hoc determination that officers shouldn't be required to make.
How do you deal with Chadwick and the requirement of exigency and temporal and proximal requirement of exigency, where the purse is in the officer's hand, and he says, I'm going to search your purse, incident to arrest. That's U.S. Supreme Court authority, so Chadwick, that's not confusing. How do you deal with that? Where's Chadwick the exigency just, there?
There isn't an exigency there. Chadwick wasn't, the search was not upheld. It was a 200-pound footlocker that was brought to the person being arrested, and the Supreme Court did not uphold the search of that footlocker. But you can't say that 200-pound footlocker is immediately associated with your person. It wasn't strapped on their back.
But it's if they've reduced it to their exclusive control, it doesn't matter if it's a 200-pound bag or a piece of luggage or a purse. If it's in the police officer's exclusive control, isn't that the gravamen of Chadwick that we should apply in this context?
It was, then it's been overruled because Riley specifically rejected that exclusive control argument. There's some specific language in Riley that's directly on point that talks about how you could say that about the cigarette pack in Robinson. The Riley court said, how is the cigarette pack not in the exclusive control of law enforcement officers? Once they took it out of his pocket and they had reduced it to their exclusive control, what's the danger of a weapon being found in it or contraband being destroyed? There isn't any. But that doesn't matter because there's a categorical rule that items that are on a person at the time they're arrested can be searched incident to that arrest. And so Riley reaffirmed Robinson, Birchfield reaffirmed Robinson, and these are more recent cases than Chadwick, which came just a few years, short years after the Keimel decision. Chadwick was perfectly reasonable. You shouldn't be able to search anything else that officers bring to you as part of the arrest. But if you're carrying personal items at the time of your arrest, there should be a categorical rule that those items are permissibly subject to a search. The arguments that were made in this case with respect to Ms. Gallegos are that as soon as she was handcuffed, she was no longer capable of accessing the purse. But that's the kind of ad hoc rule that isn't going to be functional, because how could you ever search someone incident to arrest? The minute you place them in handcuffs, then anything they have with them can't be searched.
So if in this case, how long did you say drive was from West Wendover to?
It's over an hour and a half.
Over an hour and a half down Route 80 there, right? Okay. So had they put it in the trunk and drove all that way down to the police station, how is that presenting any more of a danger to police than in?
Riley addressed that specifically as well. It talked about how officers shouldn't be required to take into custody and search for a warrant for objects they don't know what they are. There's specific language in Riley versus California that there's a danger, however slight the danger might be, which I think is the language used in Riley. Officers shouldn't be required to throw items in the back of their car and drive them for an hour and a half when they don't know what they are. There's a safety risk there. And I apologize. I really wish I was quoting language directly from these cases instead of off of memory, but Riley's very illustrative of that exact point that
rather, they shouldn't have to go put it in the back of the car and drive an hour and a half with, you know, who knows what's in that purse.
We'll see what it is.
I see.
That's why there should just be a categorical rule that we've already argued that we don't want to expand it. We don't want it to be a backpack 20 feet away. But if you walk up to an officer, they engage in a conversation with you, they happen to check your identification, and it comes out that you have a warrant. If you're carrying a backpack or a purse on your shoulder or a fanny pack or whatever it is that you might reasonably be considered to be personal property, that should be subject to a search incident to a lawful arrest. That should be a categorical rule.
Before you run out of time, do you have anything to say about the statements that were suppressed?
I do. If I was that officer, I would not have conducted that stop exactly the way it was conducted. He didn't give her an option whether to go to the interview room. Mm-hmm. The district court correctly held that that was attenuated by the fact that she had a valid warrant for her arrest. I think that The brief set forth the argument. She was not in handcuffs during the initial conversation. She was seated across from the officer. It wasn't in a jailhouse. It was in a public room with civilians. But
wasn't she placed under arrest since he found out about the warrants?
He was. And then that's so why there's...
Wouldn't he have to read her Miranda right then?
And he did. As soon as he placed her under arrest, he read her Miranda warnings, which the district court judge described as insincere and used that as a basis to not allow the subsequent statements submitted in the trial. But the sincerity of Sergeant Abrams is not the basis.
It's my understanding the court was concerned that they basically just reconducted the interview they had done without Miranda, now with Miranda, without explaining what the difference might be or that the prior statements wouldn't be admissible.
Well, and that's what was precluded by Oregon versus Elstad. The argument of the state would be she wasn't not speaking at any point. This lady was just laughing about the fact that she's a meth addict and had her own personal meth in her purse the whole time. He wasn't grilling her. He wasn't being mean to her. He wasn't attacking her. She was pretty forthcoming. And
once he forced her to go into the small room in the back and separated her from her belongings.
She wasn't separated from her belongings. They were right next to her. I mean, I guess by
she was not allowed to reach in there, right?
Yes.
She wasn't allowed to access her phone.
That's correct. He didn't say that specifically. He just asked for his own comfort if she would place her purse next to her on the table. She didn't ask to use her phone, I don't believe, but I could be wrong.
It appears that the district court had a different take. They end the order with something like, some people dance as no one's watching, and this police officer polices as if there's no body cam. It seems like the district court has a different take on how the police treated this particular defendant.
It seems to the state that she has a personal animus toward that officer who took a job out of state because he had a difficult time functioning in Elko County because that judge was not fond of him. There's deference to the factual findings of the district court, but this court has the video. There was no evidentiary hearing at which testimony was presented. You don't have to defer to her factual findings. You can watch that video for yourself and make your own judgment about was he policing like no one was watching, even though he had a body cam on and he knew that everyone would be watching.
Hey, do you want to reserve
I'll
the balance
save my
of your
3 minutes
time? Okay, rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Gammons.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Benjamin Gammon, Elko County Deputy Public Defender. I'm representing the interests of the respondent, Stephanita Gallegos. This is certainly not a case of first impression. We've had many cases dealing with the issue of searches incident to arrest. In this particular case, as has been noted earlier, Ms. Gallegos was detained on the casino floor. It was suspicion of some drug transaction occurring there. So Deputy Abrams took her to the small security office, and it is small, as you can see, certainly from the video. As has been noted earlier, Ms. Gallegos was separated from the purse. What Mr. Roche didn't mention was why. It was because Mr. Abrams had some unfounded fear that Ms. Gallegos could go into the purse and get some weaponry. One of the concerns noted in Chimel is officer safety, and that's why we have this exception to the warrant requirement. So when ultimately Ms. Gallegos is arrested, she's still separated from the purse, and Mr. Abrams has decided this is a search incident to arrest. He says it on the body cam, I'm going to search incident to arrest, even though the purse is still away from Ms. Gallegos. And what's noteworthy here is when the search occurred. Now, we've heard the state say, well, she's in the process of being cuffed, and then the search is occurring during that process. As I saw in the video, Ms. Gallegos' hands were behind her back, cuffed, before the search even began. So that gets us to Chimel, these concerns about officer safety and preservation of evidence. Where would those concerns have been if her hands are behind her back, she's separated from her back, she's certainly in no more position to destroy evidence or get weaponry in that purse when she's got her hands behind her back than she would have when she's uncuffed and not under arrest. So based on Chimel, certainly,
Well, counsel, let me ask you a question, because this case is a little different than the last case that we just heard. Would it be your position, then, that to have a search incident to arrest of a bag or something, it would have to stay on the person? So they couldn't take her purse off her, but then they could search it incident to arrest, but the minute they've stepped a foot away with it, they can't? Like, where are we drawing this line? In the last case, there was a drive to a police station. It's separate. This is actually right at the scene of the original arrest.
Well, I don't think it technically has to touch, but I think if it's in immediate control, such as in a position where Ms. Gallegos, or anybody for that matter, could access the contents of the purse to either get weaponry or destroy evidence, that should be the standard that comes straight from China. Now, I understand the state has cited Robinson. Now, the facts of Robinson are totally different. Robinson's wearing an article of clothing at the time of the arrest. He's still wearing it at the time of the search. So it's hard to analogize Robinson wearing a coat and Ms. Gallegos' purse that's separated from her. There's simply no comparison. So when they upheld the search in Robinson, that was the right result.
So there's no need, there's never a need for a search incident to arrest if it's actually after the arrest?
Well, if it's after the arrest, well, certainly with Robinson, it was after the arrest.
So, because it's on the clothing?
Correct, yeah.
Well, what about the state appears to be asking us to maybe adopt some of the other jurisdictions that talk about the time of arrest rule, because now we have practical realities of people carrying firearms. And so why should an officer be left to be unsure about putting something in his car or her car? You know, you plop something down, a gun goes off. Why shouldn't we adopt something that protects law enforcement as far as time of arrest, making sure that, in fact, the area around them is secured? Why do we make this difference of if you're not in handcuffs, you can search the person, but if you're in handcuffs, you can't? How does that change the officer's safety?
Well, I think in terms of the generalized exigency exception, certainly if there's some indicia that there's a gun inside the purse, then that would get beyond the search incident to arrest issue. In some cases, you wouldn't have the search incident to arrest option, but you would have the generalized exigency, such as if there's indicia of a gun. So in that particular case, it could be justified under a separate exigency exception to the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement. Now, the state cites Riley. Well, the thing that Riley stood for also is you can't search cell phone data if, in fact, it's being called a search incident arrest, but it's being done well after the cell phone is separated from the suspect. So while the state cites Riley on their side, not everything Riley stood for helps them, and certainly cell phone data is quite analogous to the current case we had with Ms. Gallegos, although it wasn't a cell phone that was seized from Ms. Gallegos. But the principle remains the same, is that searching the cell phone data wouldn't reach any of the issues of CHIML, namely to preserve evidence or protect officer safety. Now, Belton is a case that the state cites. Belton was decided back in 1981, and there's been plenty of precedent since, most notably from Gant. Now, if we adopt the state's rule, I mean, they're talking about Belton. I mean, the facts of Belton are far different from this case. What is noteworthy from Belton is in that case they searched a coat. But the difference between that case and Robinson is the coat was separated from Belton at the time of the search. However, Belton was one of four arrestees. One officer, four arrestees. None of those four arrestees were shackled in Belton. Whereas here, in Ms. Gallegos' case, you had two members of law enforcement, and Ms. Gallegos is shackled. So to apply Belton here, I mean, Belton is far different set of circumstances, and Gant clarified the rule with regards to search incident arrest, because people read Belton, and they thought, well, if you arrest someone in a car, you get to search that area of the car in their immediate control at the time of the arrest, regardless of what happens subsequent. See, with Gant, you didn't have a situation where the arrestees outnumbered law enforcement. It was the exact opposite situation in Gant. And Gant applied to this case would warrant upholding Judge Porter's order of suppression. See, with Gant, you had five officers and three arrestees. All three arrestees were shackled. That's far different from Belton. If we apply Belton in isolation of Gant, well, that gets you closer to the rule that Mr. Roche wants to adopt. But if we apply Gant here, it warrants upholding Judge Porter's order here. Now, the state, in its brief, cites lots of cases outside our jurisdiction. There were five cases in particular that they cite outside the Ninth Circuit. The problem with that is that all five of those cases were decided after Belton, but before Gant. So they didn't have the benefit of the Gant case, which in Gant, they suppressed the evidence because neither the concerns of Chima were met in Gant. But then you have these five cases outside the Ninth Circuit that the state tries to cite for, as persuasive authority, but ever since Gant's been decided, it's not very persuasive at all. But they did cite the Ninth Circuit case of United States versus Camus, that's spelled C-A-M-O-U, about the basic requirements for a search incident to arrest, whether the search items within arrestee's immediate control when he's arrested, which we submit that it was not at the time of the arrest and definitely not at the time of the search, of course. But the second part about that test is, did events occurring after the arrest but before the search make the search unreasonable? And that's where the handcuffing aspect comes in. And the issue of the handcuffing is vitally important to understanding why suppression was proper in the instant case, because it is the handcuffing that made the search of the purse, which was after she was shackled, unreasonable, and hence suppression is proper, because otherwise we're rewarding the bad conduct of the officer in this case. Now that brings us to Rice. The state says that there's confusion in the law. I would submit no, there is not, especially ever since Gant was decided. But in any event, in Rice, what are we dealing with? We were dealing with a search of a motorcycle and a search of a wallet. Now, where is, well, actually, that's Greenwald that dealt with the motorcycle and wallet. That case was cited in Rice. In Greenwald, they said that wasn't a proper search and incident arrest because, in that case, Greenwald's in the cruiser, quite like Gant. So they suppressed the evidence found in the motorcycle as well as in the wallet. Now, in Rice, you had, in that particular case, an arrest for operating the bicycle without the headlight, carrying a concealed weapon, and they did seize the gun. However, when they put Rice in the cruiser, they then searched the backpack and found meth, cocaine, and marijuana, among many other things. They ruled it was not a proper search incident arrest because Rice wasn't in the patrol car at the time of the search, and not in a position to destroy evidence or acquire weaponry, the two Chima concerns. The state says, page 13 of the opening brief, that if we apply Rice, that basically we get an item that's seized and then there's nothing that can be done after that, that the left holding on to it. Well, I think the state makes a valid point about the Robinson. In Robinson, you had a crumbled up cigarette pack, and Robinson said that could be searched, but in this particular case, it's not analogous to a cigarette pack whatsoever. Now, getting to the issue of whether state constitutions can grant greater rights than the federal counterpart, that's where Mr. Roche and
Before
I are going.
Before you go that, down that road, counsel, I wanted to ask you this argument. If the officer feels something when holding the purse or feels something when holding the backpack, does that permit the search to go forward without a search warrant?
I think it's a very fact-intensive inquiry. I think there are certain situations where the generalized exception regarding exigencies could warrant particular searches.
We've talked about knives and guns, but what if there is an explosive device inside the backpack or inside the purse? What then?
Yeah, there's indicia that it's a ticking time bomb. I think in those type of cases, it could be impossible to call up a magistrate and seek a warrant or draw up an application for warrant. Mm-hmm. Of course, in this particular case, Officer Abrams didn't have any kind of inkling whatsoever of anything, whether it be an explosive, gun, etc. None of that would apply to the instant case whatsoever.
So if I'm holding the purse and I can feel a gun or I can feel a knife, even though your client is shackled and I'm 3 feet away from all of you, all I can still search it without a search warrant. You'd agree with that?
At least not pursuant to the search incident arrest. I think it's a fact-intensive inquiry otherwise. I think you'd have to find another exception other than the search incident arrest.
What exception would cover that search?
I think, well, if there's an exigency, as in analogous to a ticking time bomb, for instance, where it would be impractical to expect that officer...
I'm sorry, I shifted the hypothetical on you. I went back to holding the backpack or holding the purse and could feel the weapon in it. If your client is handcuffed, can I still search it without getting a search warrant?
I think it depends on a lot of things. I think in this instant case, I think it would depend on what type of weapon we're talking about mm-hmm. here. I think ultimately, for instance, a gun. If obviously there's issues of there being a gun and it's impractical to get the warrant, I would say in certain situations, if it's impractical, you could do that. Of course, that wouldn't be this case, but yes, in a hypothetical situation, I think there's certain instances where the warrant requirement could be disposed of in very particularized instances where the officer danger is present by feeling the purse. But in an instant case, there's no indicia that Officer Abrams was feeling the purse.
I understand.
And I understand that the state's citation to Lloyd and the automobile requirement. However, there's another case that wasn't cited, State versus Bayard. In that particular case, this court said there are certain extensions of rights from our Constitution that extend beyond the federal Constitution. In Bayard, that was in the context of a strip search from somebody who made an illegal left turn in a lane change. During that strip search, there were bundles of drugs that came out of his underwear. And in terms of getting any personal than that, of an effect, you really can't. And so this court's already done that. And in terms of whether rights should be overruled, it's been the law for 22 years. And we ask the court to follow stare decisis. It's not perpetuating error. There's no reason to overrule Rice. And we ask that Rice be upheld.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Roach, you have a little over 3 minutes.
I think Lloyd is illustrative of what the state is asking the court to do in this case. You know, in Lloyd, they specifically rejected distinctions that do not square with the reasons for them. In the cases that were overruled by Lloyd, they had talked about searching parked, immobile, and unoccupied vehicles, and the court said, well, how are you going to search an occupied and moving vehicle? Like, that never happens. And that's the same kind of problem we have here. How do you do a search incident to arrest when the minute you place them under arrest, there's no longer any possibility that they'll obtain any contraband to destroy it or a weapon? That's what the exigency requirement in Rice does. It eviscerates a search incident to arrest, because once you place them under arrest, there's no need for the search. And that's the problem that we're seeking to avoid and asking this court to clarify when it revisits Rice. Is if the rule that Rice gave is applied in Nevada, officers can't ever search incident to arrest.
Well, they can search the person, they can search the clothes, the pockets, and then they can certainly get a warrant if they believe there's something else to be found in a container, right? Those avenues are still available, correct? I mean, you're saying they just can't search
it? So if they find a container in their pockets, but they're handcuffed, they can't search it incident to arrest. That's the rule that Rice would have us apply. That's not the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. That's contrary to Robinson. So this court has to have a well-reasoned and thought-out reason why it wants to extend the protections beyond the Fourth Amendment. What are those reasons? They're already going to be arrested. They have a reduced privacy interest. They're about to go to jail and be strip-searched. Their property is almost always going to be inventoried and searched for contraband.
So why not just say, well, inevitably, it's going to be inventoried.
That's what's going to happen.
Extend
if
Rice,
this court upholds Rice, that's what police forces will have to do. They'll just have to make sure that their inventory procedures are correct, and they'll find it all at the jail.
Aren't they supposed to be correct anyway?
That's fine, except that the officers have the risk of having carried the property, they don't know what it is, all the way from wherever they conducted an arrest. There's an unnecessary risk there, because the invasion of privacy isn't any greater, but the risk to the officers is increased. So is that well thought out? Is that why we want to uphold Rice? Because that's the result. We're not going to find more contraband by this court, get rid of Rice. That's not the purpose. The purpose is officers should have a categorical rule that allows them to safely operate and do their job. And they don't have that if Rice continues to be the law in Nevada. Riley has the language, and I have like 30 seconds left. But they talked about that with a cell phone. Once an officer has secured a phone and eliminated any potential physical threats, however, the data on that phone can't endanger anyone. That was the reasoning. Perhaps the same might have been said of the cigarette pack seized from Robinson's pocket, referring back to Robinson. Once an officer gained control of the pack, it was unlikely that Robinson could have accessed its contents. But unknown physical objects may always pose risks, no matter how slight, during the tense atmosphere of a custodial arrest. Officers, if they're arresting someone, should have the authority, as allowed by the United States Constitution, to search personal property on that person at the time of their arrest. And we'd ask this court to adopt that rule. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Roach. Thank both counsel for your excellent arguments and briefs. We appreciate it very much. This case will be taken under submission. I assume all three of you are driving back to Elko this afternoon.